Thank you, John. Thank you, Todd. I want to thank people whose names I don't know, who have made this event possible, specifically this morning, but as you all know, there a lot goes into this morning, not just tea and coffee and bagels and getting up early in the morning, but a lot of people's effort has gone into today, and never getting the religion, but just the people who clean this room last night, who get paid really ridiculously low wages, and should be paid living wages, or a lot more. And those people aren't here with us, but they're as much a part of this as you and I this morning, so I want to say thank you to them. When I was sitting back there, and this other gave me her card, which is really how it started, actually. And how it started was that in the 90s, I began to give a lot of talks about the environment and business environment. And after talks, people would come up and give me the card, as they do everywhere to each other. It's the way we exchange connections. And I would take those cards, and I would take them home with me in my pocket, and then when I got home, my pockets, and I would look at the cards and read them, and I was surprised at the diversity of the organizations, and sometimes I forgot maybe what the person said or tried to extrapolate the meaning of the card. And I was not a salesperson in that sense, and I wasn't building a directory, but I couldn't fill the cards away, so I'd read them, keep them, and I put them in a drawer, and I lived on a small houseboat, so we didn't have so the cards I put in the door, so I put it in a shopping bag, and the shopping bag was in the closet next to the bathroom. And so every morning when I would get dressed, then I would see the shopping bag full of cards every day after day. And pretty soon the shopping bag was full. And so then I got another shopping bag, and I started that one. And that's when I began to think, I wonder how many cards are out there, in other words, of distinct NGOs, nonprofits, volunteer associations, community-based organizations, village-based organizations, institutes, foundations, philanthropic organizations that are working towards social justice and environmental conservation and also represent indigenous people, because that is basically the cause that I was receiving. So I assumed somebody knew. Somebody seems to know everything in this world. And I couldn't find any data. There's some work that Lester Solomon does at the University of Maryland on civil society, but it's just, it's like going to the IRS and getting the form, 99 forms and listing them. You can't tell what's going on at all. And other countries have them as well, but there was no registry, there was no list, there was no directory that was complete, even remotely complete, of how many environmental organizations there were in the world. At that time, I was counting environmental organizations. So I started doing research, and I grew up in Berkeley. My father taught at the library, so I'm a little research rat. And I, never being 6 years old, probably around the stacks of Berkeley library, so I started researching, and I came up with the idea that there's 30,000 environmental groups in the world, and I just thought that was stupendous. That was a lot. And but I also realized that I was disaggregating social justice organizations from the environment, and so I included them, and that number then shot up to 70,000, then 80,000, then 90,000, 100,000. And at 100,000, I began to think, well, what does this compare to? Like the Catholic Church or Salvation Army or whatever. I'm trying to think, what is comparable to 100,000 organizations? And there was really nothing comparable. And then I look backwards in history to find if there's anything in the women's movement from Seneca Falls, 1848, or the abolitionist movement, or any of the really large social movements. So at that time, I began to say, I think that this is the largest movement in the history of humanity and people. And it didn't really make a big impression. But I kept counting the number of people. And what happened is, exactly 99 years, there was a small, it was not a experience of direct action. And then on Friday, I went and flew to give a talk in Washington, D.C., and on Saturday, and then that night, I bought the papers, you know, the Post and the Times. And then on Tuesday, I bought the Newsweek and Time. And then I started, but I was reading, you know, what people were writing about Seattle. And it was just absurd. I realized half the people were writing about it weren't even there. Tom Friedman was in New York, had a lot to say. And so what happened is I did my part with what a 10,000-word email, actually. So I did. It was like, I didn't think I would even publish it. And I sent it out to people, and it did get published in 22 different magazines around the world. And people like Harper's and Mojo said, do they want to publish it? Do they want exclusive? You know, no one else can publish it. And I said, no, anybody can publish it. So it was free, it was open source article. But the point of that was how it was organized, how Seattle was organized. And one of the reasons the King County Police and the Seattle Police got so frustrated is they couldn't find the center, they couldn't find the head, they couldn't chop it off, they couldn't get rid of it because of the way of the organization that had come underneath. And if you really trace back the organizational methodology, it goes back to the King Crime Place in 1992 in Quito, Ecuador. That is the first meeting in indigenous people since the conference. So even though people didn't realize it, the methods that were being employed in Seattle go back to the Mayas and how they organized, and to this day how they organized in Chiapas. So in reaching back and looking at this, like, you know, in a sense you realize that what created Seattle were roots and lineages go way back. And so that piece precipitated me to write about what is this movement. Because what happened on November 30th of 1999 was that civil society fell out of the And that's what happened. After that point, it could never go anywhere in the world without a lot of scrutiny and attention. Right? That was it. It could no longer be in secret, you know, and make decisions that affected every person. And so I went through four titles. And the first one was Uprising, and then 9/11 happened. And I thought, okay, no, put that one away. And the second title was a little more morose. It was about the uninvited, the forgotten, the uninvited, and the excluded, which was really from some called Dante Martos. And that was a little downer. So then I went up, I got The Other Superpower, and that was a title for a while. And I thought, who needs another superpower? And then it was We Interrupt This Empire, which I thought had humor in the name. So I was feeling more upbeat. But finally I settled on the term Blessed Unrest. And Blessed Unrest is stories of Agnes DeMille and Martha Graham were having dinner. And Agnes DeMille had choreographed the show and got all these awards and so forth. And she came back 6 months later to New York, and the show was terrible. And she and Martha Graham had dinner, and then Martha Graham, at her doorstep as they walked home, said to Agnes DeMille that, she's talking about artists, but really she said there's this queer dissatisfaction, right? This blessed unrest, you know, that makes us artists more alive than the other. Right? And I felt that that described so well the people I have met in the years and years that I've been traveling on this country and other countries, this blessed unrest that makes us more alive. And that book is really about the history of the origin of what it is that we're trying to map. So at the National Catholic Institute, we thought, well, we better try to create a database, a directory, if you will, at least a list of who was out there. And as we started to do it, the research indicated that there wasn't really 100,000 groups, there's over a million organizations in the world that are working towards the purposes that we share as well. And that this is the movement that doesn't know it's a movement. It really doesn't. It doesn't know how big it is. It can't see itself. And two reasons for that, and they're important reasons, and they're reasons that make this movement so powerful than other movements. And that is to say that this is not an ideological movement. We think of movements, we think of a charismatic male program somewhere. Said something that was interesting, and or I had revelations, or much time in the British Library. Who knows, you know? But, you know, codify his words, and it's always been his, so I'm being gender specific here, and codify those words. And then a group of factotums people then started to make sure the words were screwed up and the ideas, and they became the gatekeepers of it. Pretty soon you had. And we think of movements as ideological. And if you look at the 20th century, it was a clash of ideologies. 120 million people died, you know, arguing over these ideologies, you know, which is really about money and land and power. And what we're seeing now, today, is what I call the sunset effect of ideologies, the so-called quasi-populist movements, economic fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, neoconservatism. These are very powerful, intense movements who seize levers of power but have basically really no base. They really don't have a base. Right? So what we have is a movement that's arising that is about ideas. It's not about ideology. There's a big difference between ideology and ideas. Ideologies dictate and basically prescribe. And ideas open up possibilities and liberate. So this is an idea movement, right? And the second thing that makes this movement very different is that not only is it's truly the first bottom-up movement in the world. When we talk about grassroots movement, but the fact is that nobody really is in charge. Nobody is in control. Nobody says, when you start an NGO, when you start a nonprofit organization, who do you check with? Well, your team. But you don't check with somebody else. Nobody stamps and says, you're cool. Even our government doesn't say that. In other countries, it's a little more Washington, some of them, like China still, places like that. But for a large part of the nonprofit movement, doesn't check in with some higher authority. It is its own authority because it arises in response to insults and assaults and injustices in place, whether it be environmental or social or historical in the case of the movement. And so, What's happening here is something that has never really happened on Earth before, which is a citizens' movement. This is community taking back the world. Right? And it can be seen as powerless. It can be seen as weak. It can be seen as ineffective. It can be seen as toothless. Because, in effect, what I'm saying is that the analogy to it is that this is humanity's immune response. And we have physicians here. But this is humanity's immune response to political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation. And that the immune response always lags, it always follows the insult. And I started using that metaphor, and then I thought, well, I better find out how the immune system works. And there is the conventional Department of Defense idea, you know, the Donald Rumsfeld immune response, you know, idea that it's out there to shoot down disease. But if you actually study the immune response, actually is more interested in détente and rapprochement than it is about death. And the immune response is a very complex system. It is the most complex system in the human body. And there are those who say, and I believe, that the immune system really created the brain. And the brain is also part of the immune system. The immune system, so I woke you up good. That the immune system, in a sense, was there to deal with microorganisms, you know, bacteria and viruses and so forth like that. But the brain is there to deal with bigger things, like bears and bears and white beaters and things like that. The brain is to deal with bigger things that the immune system could not handle. So whether that's true or not, the fact is it is more complex than even the brain, the immune system. And the way it works and is through connectivity. That is, the more connected the immune system is, the more vibrant your immune system is. And the less connected it is, the more susceptible we are to disease. So I use that because my sense is that if there's a million organizations out there, the fact is that we have arisen spontaneously. But in the last 10 years, because of technology, 10, 15 years and so forth, it, with no name, this movement, is starting to get connected. And so what Wiser is about helping the business. And it started out humbly by somebody giving a card, right? no longer, it is actually modeling, or it has become what it is trying to point out itself. That is to say, it has become a process enjoined by many other individuals and organizations. And I'm happy to say that we no longer, that as a natural capitalist, we have any control over it. That is to say, it has taken on a life of its own, for which we are utterly grateful. At the same time, our job at Natural Capital Institute is to keep the lights on, preserve, make sure that we continents and pay the bills. But our collective job is to make it meaningful to the million plus organizations in the world that really need to be connected. We can connect in ways that are very robust here, in particularly places that are so wild like Seattle. But we have to remember that this is in other countries, that the value of connectivity is just astonishing. I don't know if you've ever been a city, a country mouse, you read the ads and magazines, you know, in the city, you just get out of it. But out there in the country, if you skip, you know, weather reviews or something like that, you're reading the ads, you know, for things because you're so removed from the daily salt information has. The same thing is that there are organizations out there in Botswana, you know, in Africa, in South America, in Asia, and so forth, that really feel alone. They're isolated. In many cases, they're under attack, under assault, and people are being killed, right, for standing up. The first NGO that dealt with endangered species on the Tibetan plateau, the first two members of the NGO were murdered. So it's not as though this is a safe thing for people. So connectivity and being aware of each other also provides us with a sense of not only a tool to collaborate, but a tool also to make the rest of the world aware that we are aware. And so I'm hoping that with WISER, which is building that sort of sustainable and social and environmental, social and environmentally responsible organizations, World Index of Social and Environmentally Responsible Businesses, and so forth, that we can also collectively, in a sense, sort of like the moon rising above the horizon, or the sun, whichever you prefer, having seen what men can do for 2,500 or 3,000 years for the moon, but that is the moon rising on the horizon, the full moon, so that the world can see for the first time, really, what is the largest movement in the history of humanity. That is the hold up a map, not only to itself, but to politicians, to the media, to academics, and probably more critically than anybody else, to young people. Need a basis, a concrete basis to be capable and to create and reimagine this world, which is so extraordinarily troubled and sad. There has never been as much destruction in the environment. There has never been a time when more people suffered environment than there is right now. And with that, you know, with that as our, in a sense, our palette, what we can do together is can be hugely magnified by our ability and our willingness to connect to each other and recognize each other. And my sense is, traveling around, talking, listening to people, that the time has come. And I said this a few weeks ago at Pioneers, but I was reading Martin Luther King's really first major public address after he was elected by the Montgomery Improvement Association to lead the Montgomery bus boycott. And he only had 15 or 20 minutes to prepare his first speech. And his first lines were, "There comes a time." And he kept, in good Baptist style, repeating that there comes a time and filling it out. You know. But there does come a time. You know, and this is that time. And I know we know that this is the time. But there is no other time. There has come a time. And unless we, you know, recognize that and come together, then the time will pass. The time will pass. We can basically fulfill what I think is our common world destiny, which is to make this place, which we call home, which we call Earth, a place where our children's children can then practice, enjoy, screw up as we have. And, you know, so that is the Hokavisor. Again, I want to thank all of you for coming today. John will take over from now and explain the rest of the day, because I don't understand yet, so I couldn't if I wanted to. But I do invite you all, even the ones who didn't say you wanted to meet me, the ones that did say I wanted to meet me, all of you, to help work together. It's kind of like, in the best sense, I said, this is the Oklahoma land, I should go paint it. And my series, go, take it out, paint it, grow it, change it, modify it. This is open source. This is our platform. What we did was just create a basis by listing the first 100,000 organizations. It has a semi-critical mass for things to be plugged into. And I wish you the best. You can contact me anytime you want. I won't necessarily respond the same way. But it's a